What's up, ODs and eyewear lovers? We're talking the latest trends in tech and eye care, so sit back, relax, and defocus.
If you're heading to Vision Expo East, the Exhibit Hall is the place to be to discover the latest innovations in lens technology. At the Essilor booth, you'll get a 3D experience of the research and development process behind the state-of-the-art Verilux X Series progressive lens. And don't miss your chance to explore your personal style at the Transition Style Bar, where you can try out all the colors and mirror tints available in the Transition Style Colors and Extra Active Style Mirrors. You also get a chance to learn more about the brand new Transition Signature Gen 8 technology. There are also exclusive show specials not to be missed at the booth. You can save 50% off your lab bill by signing up for Essilor's Lab Network at the show, and make sure you enter to win the complimentary training program and priority access to Transition Signature Gen 8 launch kit valued at $5,000. Talk to an Essilor sales team member at the booth for all the details and enter for your chance to win. So pull out your Vision Expo show app and star the Essilor booth at LP4233. That's LP4233. I'll see you there. Greetings, colleagues, and welcome to the Defocus Media Podcast. My name is Dr. Daryl Glover, and along with me is the lovely Dr. Jennifer Lyerly. Today, we're going to talk to you about myopia. Myopia has skyrocketed worldwide. Half of the U.S. population has myopia. As eye care professionals, we must stop thinking about myopia as simply a refractive error and start thinking about it as an eye health issue. Today's guest is Dr. Moshe Mendelson. He is working with the Essilor Task Force to eradicate myopia. Dr. Mendelson, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. I'm doing very well.
Well, Dr. Mendelson, thank you so much for joining us today. Hopefully you're enjoying your time out of the office, because I know before we started recording today, you mentioned that you had been in patient care and you see roughly 40 patients when you go into work. Is that right?
Yeah, on a full busy day, that's about right.
So obviously that's an aggressive practice schedule, I would say, but I see 20 and I'm exhausted, Daryl. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I'm around that 20-25 marker and then I'm ready to call it quits.
You know, half of my day is actually taking care of patients who I do, and these are quick encounters, so they don't take too much of my time. So I don't see comprehensive eye exams all day long, so it's like half and half. So from a practice scheduling perspective, the follow-ups for myopia management are really very quick visits, maybe 5 minutes per patient. So it's not too bad, actually.
So fascinating to me. So would you mind telling us a little bit of the background about how you were able to build a practice that's so specialized in myopia?
So I graduated from UC Berkeley about 28 years ago, and I joined an ophthalmology practice. And my ophthalmology partners specialized in LASIK, and I felt that we need to have an alternative for LASIK at that time. And that's when I decided that I'll do something a little different with myopia management. At this time, we did not really call it myopia management. We call it orthokeratology. It was not FDA approved, and I kind of did it in a dark room because it was not official. But as I started to do it, patients were very happy, and the word of mouth allowed me to go to practice. And once you do myopia management, orthokeratology, for a few patients, they become your enthusiastic ambassadors in the community, because most of the public is not aware of that. They never heard about it from their practitioners, and they're very excited about these non-surgical options. So again, once it's like a snowball. Once you do a few cases, the excited patients that you help become your ambassadors in the community, and that's how you grow the practice. Grassroots campaign, if you will.
So, I mean, it's no secret why Essilor picked you to be a part of their new task force that they have to target and eradicate myopia. What are the goals that you hope to achieve with this group?
So there are several things I think as a group we want to accomplish. One of them is to develop a recommended protocol for our colleagues so they know how to approach patients who present to their office with myopia. We also want to rally the industry around myopia, because we really want to make a difference. I also like to share my experience with my colleagues. You know, most of my colleagues do not approach myopia in the way that I would like them to approach myopia. They approach myopia more as a refractive error rather than as a disease. So when I have a patient on my chair who is 7 years of age and he or she are minus one, I don't think about them as a minus one. I think of them as a minus seven when they're 17. And once we start to think about the patient as minus seven when they're 17, with all the associated risks that we can discuss later, we are going to be a lot more assertive and aggressive in treating them. So I'd like to preempt myopia from progressing if I can, and then I know that I'm going to help the patient individually and also kind of counter that public health issue that I think will be enormous going forward.
I think you really nailed probably one of the biggest hurdles to this entire myopia discussion is how do we change the mindset of the eye doctor, of optometry? We're the bread and butter myopia management doctors, but yet overwhelmingly, even young doctors graduating from school that we polled view myopia as a refractive state and only think about the disease state as a separate entity that has an associated risk with high myopia, not the myopia itself is that disease state that they need to be intervening and treating. Do you have any ideas how we can change that mindset in a relatively short amount of time?
I think it's all about educating our colleagues and being more aggressive in the school system, in the optometry schools, right? So what I've done personally about 20 years ago, I decided to become a mentor and I became an adjunct clinical faculty for a few schools of optometry, and I made a difference because I kind of educate my colleagues who come for, you know, an internship with us about myopia and how to counter it. But again, I think we have to convince the deans of the schools to begin with about the public health issue. We have to convince them that this is really our domain. Myopia is for optometry to fight, if you will, and to initiate myopia management classes as a part of the curriculum. I think that some schools do it, but I'd like to see more schools embrace it, and I think that will be very beneficial. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is to go to the public directly. And I think that if we educate the public, moms and, you know, and fathers about myopia and consequences, and ask them to bring it up in a conversation with their eye care provider, that will also move the needle. Because I think, like in any other specialties, when big pharma advertises and patients come to us and ask us about alternative treatments, we are pulled into a discussion and sometimes we'll go along and provide the treatment to the patient, right? So I think it needs to be a two-pronged approach, educating the doctors, making sure they need to take a proactive approach, not reactive approach, but at the same time, educate the public so the public demands from us as ECPs better solutions other than just correcting the refractive error with simple sphere glasses.
So let's talk about this a little bit more in detail. Let's say that we have a patient that comes in, they're myope, and you're talking to the parents. What kind of dialogue are you having in that exam room? What are you saying to the parent so that the eye care professional can know what to say to their patients? And what is the follow-up process that takes place with a myope?
Sure. So, you know, when we look at the population, there are different segments. So if a parent who is a myope comes into the office, I don't have to convince them. They already have guilt feelings. They already know the consequences, and they are really seeking a solution for their child. And then sometimes they'll say, okay, I'm here because I heard that you're doing myopia management for my colleagues, and can you help my son? And then I'll go ahead and help them. So that's kind of the easy part of the equation. This is what our ambassadors do for us. But for the patients who are not knowledgeable about myopia, I'm going to use something that Errol Smith, who is on our panel as well, has developed. The theory is the hyperopic defocus. And what I'll educate the patient about is the fact that prescribing simple sphere glasses is actually a problem and not a solution, because as we create more of a hyperopic defocus, we create more of a problem. And once we initiate prescription with spherical lenses, I believe we are the problem, not the solution, if you will, because we encourage the prescription to get even higher based on that. So I'll basically educate them that spherical lenses are not the option and why. I'll educate them in a mild manner about consequences. I don't want to scare them too much. And basically present the various alternatives which we have now. The alternatives will be the night therapy with autokeratology lenses that has an efficacy of about 50% in slowing down myopia progression. There are the soft disposable multifocal lenses that have similar efficacy. There is the option of atropine, which is off-label, but very high, you know, success rate, about 80% slowing down myopia progression. And then I'm going to take advantage of the Brian Holden Institute calculator, which is a wonderful tool that is available for free that demonstrates the consequences of not treating myopia compared to treating myopia. And we can demonstrate that if we initiate treatment with certain modalities, we are going to get, you know, 50% reduction of myopia progression with the gas sperm lenses at night, about 50% with the soft disposable multifocal ones, and about 80% with atropine. So these are all peer-reviewed studies that have been vetted by the Brian Holden Institute. And kind of these are the tools that I show with my patients, and that's usually very powerful.
So you mentioned the studies, and for doctors who are practicing myopia management, I think we're very comfortable with the evidence out there. We educate our patients about it. But when I'm talking to other members of the medical community, I'm sometimes surprised to hear some of the pushback I get, even in my colleagues in ophthalmology, when I mention that I'm offering orthokeratology, for example, they really frown upon that and think that it's not a great great service to be providing, I think, but mostly because some of the misconceptions about overnight wear contact lenses, for example, in that one. But then again, even with diluted atropine, I'll get pushback from my ophthalmology colleagues like, oh, should we really be putting children on atropine with some of the side effects that might have to do with heart rate and things like this? So why do you think it is that MDs and the broader medical community are so slow to embrace the science and kind of almost push back against us when we become ambassadors for it within our community?
Well, I don't think it's only MDs. Look at our own communities of ODs. I mean, if you look at our own community of ODs, maybe 80% plus of our OD colleagues don't prescribe or don't believe in myopia management for some reason. And I think it's partially because we did not take the time, or the MDs or the ODs who are not embracing myopia management, unfortunately, did not take the time to learn that and understand the benefits that we can offer our patients. And not being involved in myopia management carries a higher risk compared to doing nothing, right? Because if we take the young myope who is a -1 at age 7, and this myope becomes a -7 when they are 17, and the risk of detached retinas, etc., is 4 or 5 times higher, not doing anything for them, I don't believe is the best service, right? So I'm of the opinion that doing myopia management with Gauss-Spangenberg contact lenses, prescribing atropine, is more beneficial than doing nothing in the long run. So again, I think that it's a matter of some of our colleagues did not take the time to study that. But I think that actually I can see some change, at least in my community. I've seen a few pediatricians that are starting to prescribe atropine. They, of course, cannot prescribe contact lenses, but they've read the ATOM 1 and ATOM 2 studies, and they've seen an article in JAMA, and they're actually embracing the atropine now as an option. So I actually see in my community that the needle is moving in the right direction, if you will.
Ah, that's exciting. I want to get your opinion on FDA approval, because that was mentioned a bit earlier in your discussion too. As of right now, like you said, atropine being prescribed for this is off-label. Orthokeratology is FDA approved for the correction of myopia, but not for myopia management or myopia control.
Right.
Do you think there's a future where we do get FDA approval for myopia management devices, whether it's lenses or drops or contact lenses? And if you don't think that's really in the positive, do you think that's going to hold this movement back?
There is no other alternative but to get FDA approval. I mean, that's something that I think we need to work very hard, and with SLO's involvement, I think it's wonderful because they're going to give us resources. I think what we need to do is to have several well-conducted prospective studies in several centers in the United States that include ODs as well as MDs. And if we can demonstrate to the FDA that we are controlling the axial length, I think we'll win this battle, right? So what the FDA wants to see is efficacy and safety, right? So we know that it's safe. Mark Bollinger has done many studies that show that safety pattern is as good as daily disposable contact lenses or daily soft contact lenses or even extended wear contact lenses. So I think the safety pattern is there. Now we need to demonstrate efficacy. Now, anecdotally, I know, because I've seen patients for close to 30 years, as well as some of my colleagues, that we are very good in controlling myopia from progression. But we need to demonstrate it to the skeptics, if you will, and to the FDA, who is going to demand efficacy. And the best way to demonstrate it is, again, by prospective studies over several years, maybe 5 to 7 years, showing that the axial length is well controlled and maintained using the modalities we just discussed. And I think once we have done it, we've demonstrated it, it's going to be smooth sailing almost, if you will. And then, of course, the public will embrace it.
So once the public embraces it, then we start to wonder about insurance. How much of a role do you think insurance will play in regards to myopia control down the road?
So that's a good question. I think that we don't want, as a eye care community, to let insurance dictate to us how we are going to manage myopia. And I'm going to take it from a different area. If I prescribe a certain medication for my patient, let's say a steroid, and I know that the patient is going to do very well with a branded steroid, but the insurance company dictates that I need to use a generic, for example, with Pret Forte, I know that the generics are not as effective as the brand name, we are going to run into a problem. So on one hand, we want the insurance to participate because I think it will be available in a broad fashion and affordable in a broad fashion. But at the same time, I'm a little worried that insurance companies are going to dictate to us what products to use, and that's going to put us a little behind. So it's a double-edged sword, to be honest with you. And I'm not sure that I have a good answer on that, to be honest with you. Again, on one hand, we want to be able to make it very affordable. But at the same time, I want to maintain the freedom as a practitioner to do what's best for the patient.
It's such a complicated topic. I think everything that we provide and offer to our patients, we run into that same issue, Daryl. So even just in prescribing specialty contact lenses for keratoconus, for example, it's so wonderful when I can get medically necessary coverage for these patients. And at the same time, when I'm participating in so many more plans, I'm starting to see more and more plans offer this service as covered, but the reimbursement rates are at $70, $100. They don't cover the cost of the lenses even. So it's a battle that we're constantly fighting in every aspect of eye care. What insurance is going, what coverage means, and what it means for the patient, what it means for the doctor, because that can discourage doctors from providing the service if the reimbursement is too low.
Exactly. I mean, if our chair cost is not accounted for, we'll be very quickly out of business, and we will not be able to provide this wonderful opportunity to our patients. So again, it's not an easy answer, but the bright light here, the bright spot is the following. When we started orthokeratology many, many years ago, it used to be primarily done with custom-made lenses that were gas permeable, very complicated designs, etc. But with the advent of the soft disposable multifocal contact lenses now, which are almost a commodity, I believe the price points are going to come down drastically, and a lot more patients will be able to afford this subspecialty and benefit from the benefits of myopia management using the soft disposable multifocal contact lenses in many cases. So I can see some bright spots, and I think that affordability will be enhanced over time. And again, with a company like Essilor coming into this arena, I'm sure they'll be able to innovate and reduce, the production costs. And then these savings will be translated to the patients eventually.
One thing else that I would like to see with the task force is just you guys tackle the legal aspect. You know, when we're using atropine and we're using these ortho-K lenses and it may cause some scarring, we have to have some type of paperwork that's going to basically cover our butts in regards to if something happens wrong. I mean, is that something that you guys are looking at as well? And what are you doing currently in your practice?
Right. So again, as we said earlier, it has been demonstrated by Mark Bollemer and a few of the meta-analysis studies that he has performed that there is no high risk in prescribing lenses for night therapy compared to, let's say, extended contact lenses. Saying that, we always like to have an informed consent. So I provide all my patients with an informed consent, talking about alternatives, the risks and the benefits, and I make sure they understand it. With respect to the atropine, also make sure that they understand that it's off-label. So this is the best we can do. And then, of course, constant surveillance. Right? So we need to not just give a parent a piece of paper and say, sign it, but at the same time, we need to do our due diligence and maintain our patients under constant surveillance. So I follow my myopia management patients every 3 to 4 months. I follow my atropine patients every 4 to 6 months, making sure that the lenses fit properly, making sure that the epithelium is intact, etc. Making sure that I educate my patients how to care for the lenses, not to use tap water, to use the recommended solutions for care. So as long as we are tight with our surveillance, I think that will be the best avenue to mitigate any potential future issues. And Daryl, I actually have one more thought with respect to what I think we should do at some point. One of the things we should do is to basically delegate some of the surveillance to parents. Parents bring their kids every 1.5 to 2 years to see us, and then we can detect progression of myopia. Imagine we develop a technology, cloud-based technology, where parents check their visual acuity of their children at home, and so they can monocularly. So that will bring patients into our offices a little bit sooner, and that's one more initiative that I think industry will help us develop. Put the technology in the parents' hands, make sure that parents can basically check the kids' acuity periodically, and if they see that progression, they would come to us quicker, and that will keep us busier. That's just one more thought that we can take into account.
I love that concept because, that's disruptive technology at our fingertips in a way that we can use it instead of not be a fan of it. I mean, that's something that, they can have a handheld autorefractor of some sort and they can just take those measurements periodically, like you said, and it goes straight to the physician. That way we can always monitor and track it.
Exactly.
It makes a world of difference.
Exactly. So I think what we'll develop is an iPhone or any smartphone ability to accomplish that. And that will also help us get awareness, and get the patients in offices sooner rather than later.
Creating that kind of a standard of care, if you will, I think is obviously one of the very most important things the myopia task force is going to be charged with doing. But then one of the other topics that's so important to the success of a myopia management movement is educating the public at large. And you mentioned that earlier. And partnering with Essilor, which has such a big national voice, what do you think the industry can do better to reach the public as a whole? Any ideas that have been come across even early on in this myopia task force process?
So I think the level of awareness is already been raised exponentially across the industry in the United States in general and patients. There is the recent out-of-focus film that Essilor launched that really started putting the topic of myopia directly into the public, and I think that's going to be very helpful and create a momentum. I think that as an industry and as professionals, we should also advance these conversations urging other ACPs to use materials in their offices. And what I'm doing personally is I have a very big practice, of course, of myopia management, you know, hundreds of thousands of patients, and I communicate with the pediatricians. So every time I have a patient who presents for myopia management, their pediatrician gets a letter. And in this letter, I basically introduce myself. I discuss with the pediatrician what my action plan is. And then I periodically send them a letter demonstrating the efficacy of myopia. And I actually had several pediatricians that came themselves to the office with their children to get this treatment, right? So I think that it's an ongoing campaign educating the pediatricians, because they are also a wonderful referral source. And if we basically show them the evidence and the kids, when they go to the pediatrician, basically corroborate it and say, yes, I'm seeing very well, I'm comfortable, and my vision hasn't changed, that is very helpful. So again, I think that if we convince the pediatricians that it works, show with them the studies and the evidence, that will be very helpful.
So we know that myopia is an epidemic. We know that it's not just a refractive state that we have to look at, but also a disease state. We know that we have to work on FDA approvals, and we know that we need to develop a protocol. What is the main takeaway that you'd like for our listeners to have from this podcast today?
By and large, as a community, all these in general view myopia as a refractive error, and therefore just correct rather than control the condition, right? So what I'd like to accomplish with Essilor's help is to basically change the mindset of ODs that myopia is really not just a refractive error, it's more like it's more a disease. And I think we are a very conscientious group of practitioners. Once we think that we have a disease in front of us, like glaucoma, etc., we are going to be very aggressive in making sure that the glaucoma does not become worse over time and that the patients don't lose vision because of that, right? So once we get to the point that ODs no longer think about myopia as a refractive error, but rather as a disease, they're going to be a lot more aggressive in making sure that they control the condition rather than correct the condition. I also want to accomplish a scenario in which ODs now know that myopia management is the standard of care rather than myopia correction. In other words, I want the ODs to say, you know, I must treat myopia because it's a disease. And if I don't treat myopia, knowing that we have tools now, maybe I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do ethically for the patient. So the last, you know, thought is that if we can reduce the progression of myopia by 33%, that will result in 70% reduction of frequency of myopia greater than -5. And this is where we know that most of the pathology takes place. Right. So if we can basically collectively reduce myopia by 1/3, 70% of high myopia that results in macular degeneration and glaucoma and detached retinas is going to be eradicated. I mean, this is going to impact patients' lives in a nice way, in a healthy way, but also the financial burdens of treating high myopia and loss of production is going to be affected as well. So I think that we have a lot of stake here if we can manage that myopia. It's a lot more than, you know, than we see right now. It's a much bigger picture. Here's the way we need to think about it, right? The fact that you can take a simple optical device like a lens and affect the health of the patient, this is very powerful in my mind. This is a tool that I say, wow, I can really make a difference. So Johnny, who is now 6 and Johnny 60, is not going to suffer a detached retina because I put a very simple disposable lens on his eye. Why not do it?
If that statistic doesn't inspire you, I don't know what will. So I know I'm getting these funds, thinking that, wow, that we could make such a big difference. That's so exciting to hear. So thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Mendelsohn. And we're very excited to see what the Myopia Task Force is able to help move this profession forward in 2019 and beyond.
Excellent. Yeah, it's an opportunity and obligation we have. And I'm looking forward to working with Essilor and making a difference. And once again, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to maybe share the thoughts with our colleagues.
Okay, it's a wrap. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with Defocus Media. We hope something resonated with you today. Please subscribe to our podcast and remember, we keep it 2020 around here, pun intended. We look forward to seeing you next time.